This week on One Hit Wondering, music journalist Martin Aston joins me to help pull back the curtain on two of pop history's most enduring enigmas, reclusive studio wizard Joe Meek with his band The Tornadoes, and legendary British band Talk Talk. Both had big hits here in the U.S. We're going to talk about what else they had to offer. Stay with us. One Hit Wondering is a little different from One Hit Wonder themed shows in that we take a band's one big hit and just use it as a jumping off point to explore the bigger picture. What was the rest of the album like? What was going on with the band at the time? What were those recording sessions like? Each episode I'll bring in a different guest who will help shine a light into this dark, forgotten corner of time and pop history to see what else we can come up with. First, a word from our sponsor. Is your site not ranking high on Google? Is trying to figure out how to generate more customers using Facebook causing you headaches? Let Dream Spectrum Marketing take your grief away. Utilizing search engine marketing and optimization, Dream Spectrum utilizes professional wordsmiths and marketers to craft tailored messages that not only increase your site rankings, but increase your engagement with your customers on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter. Discover how Dream Spectrum can help your business today. Call 1-800-291-2924 or go online now at dreamspectrum.com. Also, I'd just like to say today's interview was conducted over Skype, and it being Skype and technology and us talking to each other across the world, there are a few little hiccups, light distortion or some pops every now and then in the recording. So I try to minimize these as much as possible. I apologize if the poor quality bugs you at any point. Please forgive us. We will endeavor to make this as smooth and professional as possible in the future. So bear with us. Now, I'd like to introduce my guest for this episode. Martin Aston has been a freelance music journalist for 30 years, writing for the likes of UK publications such as Mojo, Q, Radio Times, The Guardian, BBC Music Online, and Attitude Magazine. He most recently wrote an epic book on the history of the 4AD record label, Facing the Other Way, The Story of 4AD. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
What was your experience like writing about a record label like 4AD that has so much history?
Well, with that history comes fans' expectations and sense of, are you going to tell the story that they want to hear or that they think is the truth of the matter, because, you know, 4AD has an incredibly loyal fan base, which carries on to this day. So there was a certain sort of weight, I guess, or a pressure to make sure that I, you know, dotted every I and crossed every T. It's not just the story of, say, the bands that sold lots of records. So it's not just the Pixies story or the Cocteau Twins story. It's the story of pretty much every artist.
Well, I mean, what an undertaking, not only for how long 4AD has been going and the sheer amount of music they've put out, but also just, like you say, the obsessive fan base that they have. And there's very few labels you could have picked who would have commanded such fervent study of what you're writing. It's like the Star Wars of record labels, you know. You've got an obsessive fan base. So, yeah, it was never going to be an easy task, was it?
No, I mean, it wasn't an easy task, but I don't think sort of writing a book and detailing a history is ever going to be an easy task. And if you've got a lot of characters, all of whom, you know, have their own version of events and whose memory might not be as good as it used to be for all various reasons, and you put that through, you know, the sort of filter of time and filter of whatever alcohol or substance abuses were endemic. It was tricky, but it was the most incredible project to be part of, because obviously I have, you know, the utmost respect for 4AD and for Ivor Watts-Russell, who co-founded the label and, you know, and ran it for 18 of the 19 years single-handedly that he was around before he sold up his share of the label and disappeared into the New Mexico desert, which is all part of the story. And Vaughn Oliver, who did all the artwork, with help from Nigel Grierson in the early days with his fantastic photographs, and then with Chris Big in the later, sort of through the 90s. You know, they were brilliant characters, brilliant artists, whether it was, you know, Kristen Hirsch or Charles Thompson or bands like Rima Rima that people don't actually know about. So, you know, they all had their story. So it was just a question of getting it down and hopefully telling the truth, really.
First up, we had the Tornadoes with their album The Original Telstar, The Sound of the Tornadoes, which is released on London Records. These guys were both a backing band for Billy Fury and essentially Joe Meek's in-house go-to musicians for his crazy productions. I think the main reason why so many of us know them, at least here in the US, is because of this one track in particular, Telstar. It was a pretty unlikely number one, being that it was an instrumental about a communications satellite. I remember hearing it on AM radio, which is just, in here in America, it's just the perfect outlet for that sort of song. Because, I mean, it's just so fuzzy and it's everything's so dreamy anyway. And then that comes on and it just sounds like it's from another planet. It's just it's a bizarre song to begin with. Even today, by today's standards, it's a pretty weird song. So 1962. And the fact that it was number one was just, it's so mind-blowing.
It sounds like the, you know, future. And it has such a sort of, it has such a rousing, sort of uplifting quality to it. You can just see why people, you know, just went crazy for it, because it just sounded like, you know, some sort of anthem for a, you know, for like a brave new world, really. Just, you know, it just tapped into something extraordinary. There was that sort of space age feel, the sort of space age race, even, because Joe Meek was first inspired by Sputnik, which, you know, the Russian spacecraft that, you know, that first went up there. And he actually made a whole record called I Hear a New World, which was his own. I mean, it's the first ever sort of concept record, I guess, that it was about, I mean, the man on the moon, or people on the moon, or creatures on the moon. So, I mean, he had form in making music of that ilk, but that was just something that he had worked on personally, which wasn't a sort of big hit. Joe Meek had a lot of fingers in different pies, and he was sort of the first independent producer who, he was a real sort of boffin maverick character, and he had a studio above a shop in North London in the Highbury area. He was just churning out records. I mean, you know, during the same time period, I read that Phil Spector made, you know, 25 records. Joe Meek, during that period of time, made 141 records. So he was just sort of churning them out. But he just seemed to bring this, you know, melody out of the ether. This tune came to him whilst he was lying in bed one night, and then sort of hurried downstairs and, with the help of different people, you know, managed to put this tune out in a demo form and then polish it up.
Some would say that melody came to him because he was ripping it off of a film soundtrack. Did you read about that?
Yeah, well, that actually, the court case that stopped him getting royalties for most of the time that he was still alive, 3 weeks after he actually killed himself, the court case was ruled in his favour. I mean, he says he never heard that French song, and he probably didn't. It was quite possibly somebody being extremely opportunist.
Yeah, it's what a shame. Have you heard that song?
No, I haven't.
Well, I have it right here, so we can judge for ourselves. I'm going to give it a little play here. Okay, I'm going to cry foul on that. Yes, there are some similarities, but I don't think that in any way would constitute an infringement and require this to be wrapped up in the courts for years. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess there is a sort of a four-note passage that is similar, but I think when you actually listen to Telstar, it's by far the more sort of rounded, developed melody and much more memorable. I mean, maybe there's three notes which, I mean, I can understand why somebody might think that it's copied. And, you know, Joan Meek was extremely opportunist and, you know, we'll never know. Maybe he was inspired by it. But, you know, there's been many a song inspired by other songs and even ripped off, which somebody has then used as the basis for something much, much better or different. So, I mean, I think it is, you know, suitably different.
Yeah, I agree with that. I doubt it would hold up in a court today. I mean, this is obviously way before sampling or anything, you know, the sort of cut and copy and paste culture.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how Joe Meek would have ever have heard this French soundtrack, because his opportunities for hearing that song would have been very few and far. So
I read somewhere he was on Netflix, so maybe he did. Not really.
I did actually want to say that the reason why Joe Meek went back to this space age theme, I mean, it has a nice tie into the States, but it was inspired by the first ever live broadcast from the States to Britain.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, Telstar actually came in, which is why, you know, he named it after that. The first image that that we actually saw in Britain was of a sort of ghostly image of a man sitting at a desk, which the fact that it was this sort of ghostly image was apposite, because Joe loved a good séance. He was, you know, he was very much influenced by mediums and things that people told him, and he had a lot of superstitions.
Just before leaving that, I read somewhere the other day that he took his tape recorder into a graveyard and he came across a cat and was convinced that the cat was speaking to him, like a spirit was speaking through the cat to him. And I actually listened to a recording of it. And it's just like, it's the cat's meowing, but he kept talking to it. Like, what are you saying? Or do you need help? Are you trapped?
Meow.
It was, interesting chap, Joe Meek. Eccentric. When you hear the record, you can understand why, in a way, Telstar is this one-hit wonder, because he couldn't replicate it. And when you listen to a whole album of kind of up-tempo instrumentals, which are sort of trying for this sort of Brave New World again, it just doesn't really work. And, you know, one actual criticism at the time from a leading British DJ David Jacobs was he said it was, you know, Telstar, which of course was brilliant, but at the time David Jacobs said it sounded like a third-rate song from an ice skating rink, and which was extremely harsh. And of course he ended up being proved wrong. But when you listen to the album and, you know, subsequent singles, then you can understand that it does sound like kind of music for people to ice skate to. It just doesn't have that same energy or maverick spirit about it. I mean, that's my view of the album. It's just, it's very pleasant and, you know, tuneful, but it just doesn't get there.
Yeah, I would say that the innovation definitely is not shining through all songs as much as it is on Telstar. I actually thought it was a better album than I'd expected. There are definitely a couple of songs that I think are pretty generic sounding, like the Swinging Beefeater. And a couple, they were just sort of very average instrumental pop songs.
Red roses and a sky of blue. Well, Telstar gives you an image of something sort of fantastical. Red roses and a sky of blue does sound like something that, you know, you might, you know, ice skate to in 1962 or 1963.
I'm not going to be able to forget this ice skating image now that I want to listen to these songs. Thank you very much.
There are a couple of one of the follow-up, well, I mean, in the States anyway, one of the follow-up tracks was from an EP called Riding the Wind. And that's got a kind of, you know, I mean, it's memorable. You've got Jungle Fever, you've got Popeye Twist. Those that have the better song titles are the better songs, whereas songs that are called things like Theme from a Summer Bass and Dreaming on a Cloud and The Breeze and I think, you know, it's almost sort of, you know, spelling it out. He's just not inspired, and he's not inspired. There's no image in his mind that can take the place of this sort of ghostly apparition of a man sitting at a desk being beamed from the other side of the big pond. So that's my view of the album anyway. I mean, 12 songs, it's only 29 minutes, it's over pretty quickly. It's like a lovely half an hour, but it doesn't have the sort of sheer brilliance of the sort of 3 minutes and 17 seconds of the title track.
Yeah. I noticed when I was looking at research for this that he only wrote 3 songs on the album, and he had another collaborator, Jeff Godard, who... I think he did Jungle Fever.
Jeff Goddard was generally better at writing, you know, vocal melodies, and whether it was, you know, John Layton's Johnny Remember Me, and he probably wrote, you know, the Honeycombs big hit here, which was the sort of second number one that Joe Meek had. And I mean, I just think Goddard was a better, you know, songwriter rather than a sort of instrumental songsmith. Mm-hmm. I'm being a bit down on the record. I think it just comes after that, you know, having such a brilliant title track. I just think that the album is, I mean, that's why we don't ever think of the album. But then again, we don't always think of, you know, the early Beatles records as being special. So,
yeah, I think that really typifies the whole spirit of the one-hit wonder and why this happens to artists. When you have such a ridiculously popular, really catchy song that it's just impossible to ignore, which this Telstar is all of that. It'd be really difficult to follow up with something that, captures the zeitgeist like that does. That's not to say, I think he did some other really good productions. I don't think anything really approached Telstar after that in terms of maybe the innovation or the sheer popularity. But I think it was too big. It was just too big.
Well, it was too big. And also that the band couldn't bring anything to the table because, they were just session players. And also, I think there was a lot of pressure on them because instrumental bands of that ilk were put out of fashion, because when Telstar was going to number one, there was this new band coming up, going into the sort of lower reaches of the charts called the Beatles. Basically, Merseybeat slaughtered bands, whether it was Tornadoes or the Outlaws, even the Shadows, who Batcliff Richard really suffered during that period, and they were actually much better known as a bona fide band than the Tornadoes, who were basically Billy Fury's backing band. It was a complete game changer. And every follow-up, in Britain, Globetrotter was actually top five single after Telstar, but after that it just tailed off really quickly. And the band didn't have one founder member left by 1965, and they were just doing one night stands around Britain. It's a sad story.
That's a shame. We didn't get more from him. I would have loved to have heard what he would have done in the disco era.
If only he hadn't shot himself.
I know. Speaking of which, yes, there is a dramatic conclusion to his story. I only found out just a few days ago that his movie came out in the UK ages ago. We never heard anything about it over here.
Oh, okay. No, it's no classic, but it tells the story and it's got all the music. And he was a deeply unhappy man. He was actually found in a public toilet, and it was sort of in the company of other gentlemen, and it was in the papers and everything. And it was a very, very tricky period. And I think that sort of fed into the whole sort of feeling of, paranoia and self-loathing and unhappiness. And yes, it all just came to a very nasty end when he shot his landlady and then shot himself.
Thanks for bringing us down here, Martin.
It's either art or happiness. You can't have both.
It's black or white. I totally agree.
Yeah.
Not really. So you would recommend the movie maybe more than the album. What do you think?
Yeah. I think that the film is more engrossing. It's more revealing. I just think that the album is a period piece, and it's a sort of lovely way to spend 29 minutes, but don't go looking for the kind of the brilliance that the actual title track has. And yes, I think that the film is a better accompaniment to the track, and it'll also give you more of an idea of what Joe Meek did. It wasn't just rinky-dink ice skating soundtracks, which obviously Telstar wasn't. That's the thing. The actual track itself wasn't, even though this DJ likened it to it. But when you hear the album, maybe you might think that he had a point.
Yeah. Well, certainly if you're not really into Telstar, then you'd definitely be best to avoid the album, because there's nothing more that's going to grab you on that one either. Moving on to the second album in today's podcast, we're going to be talking about Talk Talk's It's My Life, which came out on EMI in 1984. People tend to know them either for their catchy early 80s synth pop hits or for their darker atmospheric output starting from the end of that decade. So Martin, from a US perspective, Talk Talk's life as a pop band was pretty short-lived. I think this album peaked at number 42 over here. What about in the UK?
It was a hit album. They actually had a bigger hit with the with the album that came after it, which was The Colour of Spring. Mm-hmm. So they aren't a one-hit wonder over here. I mean, they probably had about five or six hit singles up until the point that they then sort of changed from being nominally new wave or new romantic into what people sort of, you know, see as the roots of post-rock, kind of merging of jazz and ambient and rock and whatever it is you people do. People like you, John Mark, whatever you do.
I should preface anything I say about this before I go any further with saying I don't really consider Talk Talk to be a one-hit wonder. They're only considered for the show because they, here in the U.S. anyway, they're very much known to the general public by this one song, It's My Life.
Right.
Obviously, they have a very dedicated cult following who knows them more for their last two albums, Spirit of Eden and Laughingstock. I actually really like them for all their material. I originally heard them when their first album came out, which I think was called The Party's Over.
Yep.
And I love that song, Talk Talk. And I liked everything that they did throughout their entire career. But obviously, I like them for different reasons when Spirit of Eden came along. But I remember being in middle school. I believe I was in middle school when Life Is What You Make It came out of Color Spring, and I really love that song. That's definitely my favorite song of theirs from their earlier incarnation. I really like It's My Life too, but I, for some reason, that was the one album I never bought when I was growing up. Even though I did like it, I bought the first one and I bought everything after that, but not that one.
Yeah, I actually don't own the earliest records, though. I do own a best of for that period,
which they released about 20 versions, I think, of the best of.
But I think you can tell with each record that he was trying to get to a different place, a sort of more what you might call more serious, less sort of pop centered place. They started off being, you know, very much likened to Duran, whereas by the end, you know, I don't know what you would liken them to, but it certainly wasn't Duran Duran.
No, I would say not.
Maybe it was Sun Ra. No, I mean, obviously, and maybe more delving down into sort of, you know, Miles Davis crossed with Van Morrison's Astral Week, something down that path. It's My Life is certainly more in that sort of in the former, in the sort of pop vein, but Mark Hollis, who was the singer and the main songwriter, you can just hear him straining to want to sort of be more serious about it. Like a Morrissey character, he hated the whole sort of feeling of sort of pandering to the demands of the music industry and the kind of remix culture which sort of ripped through. He just didn't want to play the game, and clearly that was proven by the way he turned, you know, his back on pop music and changed the whole sound and emphasis. And then, of course, has left the music industry, apart from, I think, one piece of music on a film soundtrack. I think it's the only thing he's done. I think like a minute or 2 minute piece of music in the last, you know, 15 years, maybe.
Yeah. I'm always a firm believer of just stopping while you're ahead. I would love for him to do something else, but at the same time, I'm pretty satisfied with what he was a part of in his time.
It's sort of like a sort of Kate Bush, maybe. It was always going to be interesting to know what Kate Bush would come back with after X amount of years. And I think that's what interests me. But I don't have to hear it. I'm just interested to know what he might come back with, because, you know, Scott Walker too. Like, what kind of music do they now hear in their head all these years later?
So going back to this early album, do you have any highlights in particular? Or what are your favorite songs on it?
The title track, and also another single from the album, Such a Shame, I think is really, you know, my sort of standout track from that record. It's a shame. I don't know, there's a kind of mournful quality to Hollis's writing. You can just sense that he's not very happy.
I like all the songs that you pointed out. There's a couple, like there's one, Tomorrow Started and Does Caroline Know. Those are my other favorites.
Don't look back until you cry.
There are a couple that I think are not near as good, and that I think maybe I can see why Mark Hollis might have stepped back and listened to them and been like, oh, maybe it's time for a change. Like there's one call in the Night Boy. It definitely sounds more 80s pop. Even though I don't think anything they did was throwaway. I think his, like you said, there's such a beautiful, mournful quality about his vocal. I think it immediately gives gravity to everything that he sings on. So
the album got made with a guy called Tim Freese Green, who ended up becoming a sort of nominal fourth member of the band. It was never actually, you know, stated that he was a member, and he produced the records, he played keyboards on them, and in the end, you know, he and Hollis wrote all the songs. By the end, Talk Talk was really just Hollis and Freese Green. I think Freese Green has got something like 3 songwriting credits on this record, of which a couple are really good songs and one isn't so good. So it was, you know, it was like a work in progress, really.
They kind of seem like an earlier version, or at least the trajectory of the band and the way the producer is a part of the band. Is it reminds me a little bit of Radiohead with Nigel Godrich, and they started out with this big hit and then they kind of threw all that away.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a better comparison, really, to Talk Talk than the Smiths, who I will not mention again during the course of this interview, in the sense that they had this big hit and then really felt very awkward about it, and then worked their way slowly towards another place, which obviously Radiohead did with Kid A, when they're just doing something totally on their own, following their own muse and not wanting to actually compromise. And certainly in terms of a kind of a character, you would say that Mark Hollis was probably quite like Tom York. People would think that Tom York was kind of grumpy and a bit grim and really wanted to, you know, sort of stand on his own 2 feet and wouldn't just want to listen to an A&R man or, you know, be told, go back and write a hit single and stuff like that. So, I mean, it really follows that same arc of how a band sort of changes over time. So, yeah, so this would be their Pablo Honey, and maybe, you know, The Color of Spring was their The Bends, and then by the end they were doing their own version of Kid A.
Yeah, I guess the main difference being that Tom York doesn't seem to be desperate to get out of the business, and he's happy to keep producing records, where Mark was just felt done with it.
Yeah, and I also think with Mark Hollis not talking, not being in the industry and never being interviewed. I think, you know, for the last, I don't know how many years of Talk, he didn't do any interviews. So I think that the other members of the band have sort of joined him in the, you know, the kind of silence. Silence is golden, as they say, you know, it just, why actually justify anything? Just let the music speak for itself.
Yeah, well, they stopped at the right place, I think. I'm glad they didn't stop after It's My Life, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad they went as long as they did. So that's, there's no regrets there on my part.
I mean, how many Talk albums are there? I think there's 5 Talk records and 1 Mark Hollis solo record. I mean, that's six albums. I think that's a good number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does anybody need a 7th Talk record? I mean, it might be brilliant.
I bet it would be. So what do you think in terms of the quality of this as a album as a whole? Do you recommend it? How do you feel about it compared to the album that came before and the album that came after it?
I think it's better than the album that came before it. I don't think it's quite as good as the album that came after it. So it's like in the middle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like they're having a party and then the party's over. It sounds like the party never started. And I think often those records can have more life to them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to say that because the first album is called The Party's Over. That was completely not tied into that, just in case I'm accused of making bad puns out of album titles.
I thought it was really well done. I was going to give you a little drum roll for that. But we'll let it go, though.
Okay, thank you.
Before we go, is there anything coming up that you want to plug? Any projects on the horizon for you that you're getting yourself involved with?
I recently interviewed Taylor Kirk, who goes by the name of Timber Tambra, who has an album coming out called Hot Dreams, which is stunning, and everybody who's listening to this podcast should at least try and hear it, if not buy it. It's a beautiful record. It's his 5th album, but I think by far his best. I think it's on Arts and Crafts in America, and over here it's on Full Time Hobby. I'd like to plug that because it's a stunning record.
Great. I don't know it. I will check it out.
If you're a fan of, say, Richard Hawley and Lee Hazelwood and Roy Orbison, somewhere in the middle of that is Timber Tambra.
That sounds right up my street.
There you go. So I think I should plug that. Oh, no, I can plug the 4AD book. It's coming out in paperback this summer. It's coming out in the UK in June. As far as I know, it's coming out in the US in September via the Friday Project, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And it's less likely to break your toe should the book fall on your foot. Because it's less heavy, but
great. Is that edited down or is it the same material?
No, it's the same grueling forensic breakdown of 4AD. It's just in a sort of softer shell.
I see.
But with the same beautiful cover art as done by Vaughan Oliver.
It is beautiful.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. All right. Well, Martin, I hope to talk to you again soon. Maybe we can get you on another show in the future.
Okay. That would be good.
Thank you for being so willing.
You're very welcome.
And that wraps it up for this episode of One Hit Wondering. If you have a suggestion for a one hit wonder that you think deserves some attention, or if you have any comments on this or previous shows, why not drop us a line? Our email is onehitwondering@gmail.com. That's the number 1, hitwondering@gmail.com. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We're @onehitwondering. Again, that's the number 1, hitwondering. And lastly, you can now subscribe to our show on iTunes. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the Dream Spectrum Media Podcast Network.